So I think that was the kindest and most humbling introduction that I've ever gotten, and actually really touching, because very much like Hatem said, what we had planted in us really was an understanding and the seed of what it means to be a principled part, member, and representative. And I don't mean representative in the official sense, but in terms of echoing the calls of our people. That was really learned by our elders, and though he's not much older than me, I would say that Hatem is definitely one of them. And what they've done, and I see is happening at the AAAN and through Rasmi and all the great people here, is this kind of constant sowing of, you know, what I think I'm going to refer to a bit tonight. And even though I'm not talking about a very critical issue, I do think that we can tie everything that's happened. So before I continue, Hatem, my gratitude to you, to the Merkez, to Rasmi, for your lifetime of work. And I'm very humbled and afraid I'm going to disappoint you with tonight's presentation, considering the introduction. But I do think that even though we're shifting, that the gist of what I'm going to discuss is related to all of these things and related to how we can defend around it. Specifically, what Hatem was bringing up about having to force open spaces for young people, for our people, who, no matter who they are, here and abroad, to have their voices heard. So I'm very thankful to be here. We're coming now upon 65 years of more formalized, codified Israeli occupation. We're facing a very desperate counter-revolutionary movement in the Arab world. And we're seeing unquestionably increased political prosecutions here in Chicago, in New York, throughout the U.S., and even in international systems, as we see with Interpol, which is criminalized even now by systems that were created and shaped by colonial powers. But what we're also seeing is all of this unravel in a way that it hadn't previously, which means that we have opportunities that we did not have previously. The tools of colonialism, especially in the Arab world, have centered around Orientalism, right? And that's defining what the Arab or the Easterner is like, right? Defining his characteristics. And for the younger folks here, I would ask you to keep in mind, or if you guys are young enough, the Bugs Bunny cartoons, if you ever saw the image of the Sultan, right? Pot belly, right? That's the essentializing, that's the essence of Orientalism, right? So the colonialists did that. They defined what the Arab is like. And in so doing, right, they also defined what his nature is and therefore what his rights are, what he is or she is entitled to. Now that Orientalism was used as a tool of colonialism to expand, right? You make them a dispensable people, you limit, you define them, you limit their rights, and you expand and usurp their resources. Orientalism has now expanded and evolved to include Islamophobia, the anti-Muslim racism, right? And this has justified the expansion not in the Arab world, but into the Muslim world. And all of this combined with the expanded definitions of terrorism, the expanded war on terrorism, has allowed not only for the prosecution in court of those who disagree or do not remain within the limits of that identity, the limits of their rights, to basically criminalize and wage war without all of the formalities needed for war, without a declaration, without the need for governmental approval, on ideas, ephemeral, moving groups and ideas throughout the world, primarily throughout the Arab and Muslim world. And so this all goes back to the heart of colonialism, which was justified by these two ideas, right? Orientalism now turned Islamophobia. And in order to have done that, what was necessary was that we would accept as true false constructs, right? Democracy and self-determination in the Arab world was crushed unless it served imperial interests, the interests of the American and Zionist entity. And it was only when Egypt was neutralized as a political military force in 1973, in the failed attempted retaking of the land in 1973, that we saw that the Israeli government, that the Zionist entity, was able to continuously invade Lebanon. So Egypt was neutralized on the west, and Lebanon became more, and the east became more easily accessible. And so it was in there that the Zionist entity continued to expand. And it was the removal of Egypt from the regional stage that also isolated the Palestinian resistance and marked the political separation of the Palestinian struggle from the Arab world, which people were forced to believe was necessary for their own safety and stability. So separate yourselves from the political struggle of the Palestinians so that you don't have the threat of the Israeli war machine. And as Palestinians were forced to increasingly act alone in resisting Zionist expansions and assassinations, they were also more easily prosecuted and targeted abroad, as we saw in Nixon, who issued directives to have Palestinians and pro-Palestinian activists arrested in the U.S. at the same time that Palestinians were being forced into this niche in resistance. So each expansion fed the other, from the Israeli into Egypt, Palestine, and Lebanon, to the U.S. in narrative, political activity, and expansion, right, in the Arab world, in the Muslim world, Southeast Asia. And this also shaped the narrative and the framework within which the Palestinian struggle for liberation was overwhelmingly discussed. And there was a sharp shift from the language of liberation toward a language of human rights, negotiation, law-based framework. And it was the constant calling, almost begging, for the implementation of these rights that were defined by the very people from whom we were seeking to take back these rights, and a constant calling for the implementation of rights by the people who benefited most from taking those rights away from us. And of course, not a single victory was had in this framework. In fact, all this did was prolong and enable the Zionist occupation and imperialism to expand in Palestine and in the Arab world. And while those who sought other options, while those who did call for resistance and liberation were, again, prosecuted. But all of this depended and still depends, like we said, on these artificial constructs, falsehoods that not only the world had to accept as true, but that we as Arabs, as Muslims, had to internalize and believe to be true so that we actively or passively supported them and we operated within this paradigm. And some of those, I'm going to list a few of them. The first one is that a power or a certain people has the right and the ability to define other people and determine which rights they have. Second, that only state armies have the power to protect or defend the people. Third, that societies cannot function without the state system. Fourth, that rights can only be enforced or protected by tools of the state system or the international system, as in the UN. Fifth, that the nation-state systems in the Arab world are immutable systems with solid, defined borders and policies, and therefore they are separate people. The sixth is that the threat that Israel poses militarily is far greater than the damage or the threat that the Arab people face as a result of the concessions and agreements, political, economic, and otherwise, made with Israel and the U.S. and the tools of imperialism to keep that same military Zionist threat at bay. Seventh, that Israel and its allies are the ultimate undefeatable power. And eighth, that the world would forever believe that the Zionist entity, this beacon of colonialism, the military police of imperialism in the Arab world, is and will forever remain in the eyes of the world as the eternal righteous victim that faces a constant common threat, which forms the false foundation for a need for constant war, which, as we know, was nothing but a cover for their continuous expansion. Every single one of these, as we sit in this room today, every single one of these false constructs upon which the expansion of the Zionist entity in Palestine throughout the Arab world, every one of these false constructs upon which imperialism, domination of foreign interests in the Arab world has relied, is unraveling in a way that it really has not, that we have not seen previously. We saw the escalation of this unraveling begin to accelerate in 2000, at the beginning of the Third Intifada, as a response to the failed Palestinian Authority and Oslo agreements. Then in 2005, when the resistance in Gaza forced the evacuation of settlers from Gaza, right, and prevented or made it increasingly difficult to sustain ground troops and protect settlers in Gaza. Then again in 2006 in Lebanon, where the power, the military might of the Israeli army was challenged by what can at best be described in legal or political terms, a militia with not very advanced weaponry. In 2008-2009 massacres of Gaza, we saw the unraveling of the eighth and one of the most critical false constructs, the idea that the Zionist entity was a victim, really spiraled beyond the control of even the strongest imperialist-aligned media outlets. And then in 2010, perhaps one of the most important, was the massive show of opposition to state systems in the Arab world. A refusal of people in Egypt and Tunisia to work within the rights-based framework that they were forced, and the takeover of the Tunisian and Egyptian regimes by the people, one that's still continuing, of course. But millions of civilians were able to take down and challenge armies that had almost the same capacity as the Israeli occupation forces, and successfully. Today in Tunisia, it's almost, I believe it's criminalized to normalize with the Israeli government. And in Egypt, the mere discussion of rescinding Camp David really speaks to the fact that these constructs, which have forced us into this kind of defeated, dependent, and not just a charity state almost, are coming undone. Because when you can talk about, criticize Camp David and demand transparency, because there are a lot of secret terms to the Camp David agreements, then people realize that the tools of imperialism, that Zionism and the Zionist occupation forces are not sacred and they are not undefeatable. Nothing about imperialism, nothing about the Israeli government, the Zionist entity, is sacred. And the state was not challengeable, was not unchallengeable either. The people's political, economic, social concessions to the U.S. and Israeli, European, imperial, and neoliberal tools had not brought them prosperity and safety, and they understood that that framework was no longer a viable one, and they were not going to sit there and wait for the U.N. or the U.S. or the Israeli government to continue to define who they were and which rights they were entitled to and when they were entitled to those rights. And that is the self-determination that Hatem was talking about that is so critical to keeping a central part of any liberation movement. And it was in light of, and because of their wholehearted attempts, really, throughout the Arab world, to try to engage and operate within this framework, thanks, that led them to this full disillusionment, right? People have said this is not the first time that resistance has come. This is not the first time that it's unraveling. But it's the first time after a really, I don't like using the word dedicated, but, you know, a forced, a really oppressed maneuvering within all of these layers of oppression and suffocation, UN-based, Palestinian Authority-based, trained by the British MI6 and the CIA and Dayton, you know, the Palestinian Authority, the Israeli government, the Arab regimes, the Arab League, all of these layers forcing the Palestinians to operate within this right-based framework, and they took it, and they took it for a long time, and having tried it, having said that they had given it their all, and I'm reminded of you know, a quote by Saab Irakat in the Al Jazeera leaks, where he says, you know, we're the only ones who have put in all the imams that we want in the khutbas. We've shut down the radios. We've imprisoned and killed our own people. What's left? Right? So they had done everything to operate within that framework, and clearly it had failed. And so seeing this, and then looking to Lebanon, looking to Gaza, the people understood what would work, what would not work. That continuing to accept status as inferior, as someone defined by another, as someone whose rights could either be completely taken away or otherwise delayed, was not effective. And that what was effective was resistance. And so now in the real world, in the Arab world, on a real and measurable level, and I don't mean this in rhetoric or empty, you know, feel good, here's a victory, but in real anti-imperialist perspective, you know, in the Arab world, the litmus test of Arab governments is really becoming what their real, practically implemented anti-imperialist policies are. And that speaks a lot for the lack of trust and willingness to continue within the framework they'd been forced into, especially over the last 40 years. Turning to Palestine, historic Palestine, the borders itself, you know, there we saw a muted and really repressed post-Oslo and even during the Intifada West Bank and Gaza Strip. And even though the Intifada of 2000 fizzled out, right, by a few things, and you know, a combination of the change of leadership in the PA, the deterioration of Arafat's health, the evacuation of settlers from Gaza, the acquiescence of the PA to international forces, and the acquiescence forced, albeit to the PA, really left us in a kind of a hanging spot in the West Bank. And all of the roadmaps that we saw, Oslo, the Paris protocols, all of these had failed. Even the incessant cooperation of the Palestinian Authority with all of these international bodies, and then the almost outright selling of Palestinian rights to the Zionist entity, proved that nothing was going to appease the Zionist entity, that nothing was going to stop the expansion, nothing was going to stop the imprisonment. All of the roadmaps, the Saudi, Qatari, American, the quartets, the Paris protocols, nothing provided an iota of protection for the Palestinian people. There might have been some moving of checkpoints around in the West Bank, so somebody from Hawara could say, oh, look, it's been moved to Za'atara, okay? Khisat, Hararat, Palestine. None of that was enough to appease the people. The attacks by settlers increased without any sort of protection because the Palestinian resistance in the West Bank was quelled by increased repression by the Palestinian Authority. Nothing did what the masses were able to do outside of, again, outside of the rights-based framework and outside of the state system, right? In the West Bank, we saw throughout Palestine, we saw the power of the prisoner exchange, right? Shortly followed by the immense power of the longest, the most historic prisoners' hunger strike in the world, right? We hadn't seen progress like that made with regards to prisoners' rights ever. I mean, the closest that we had, to touch a little bit on prisoners in Palestine, the closest that we had was, I think it was in the late 80s, when there was a story of a political prisoner that was leaked, and it was because he had been so tortured in Israeli dungeons that he had become paralyzed. And this story was leaked to various agencies in Europe, and there began a legislative boycott of the Israeli government, and that forced a shift in the torture methods, right? Nothing really changed. It just shifted. They were able to come up with another cover. But since then, and even aside from that, and though that's not comparable, nothing made progress like the prisoners' strike did or the prisoner exchange. In the 48 territories, we saw increased repression, increased racism, more vulgar, outright racism. I mean, here we are couching our words, and there goes the majority of Israeli society. You know, if you saw any of the videos coming out from coming out during the Gazi War of Zionists in the 48 territories, but really vulgar tag operations, stuff that, you know, people thought just didn't exist. And of course, we had Gazi. But, you know, all of this, everything was made irrelevant by the resistance. And Gazi, which had been neglected by the Arab world probably since the late 70s, struggled since then, was able to remove the settlement cities, right? That's what settlements are. And now Gazi is Gazi, malnourished, under siege, surrounded by a wall. And if, you know, I think that we all knew that the Israeli government intended to bomb and massacre Gazi again, right? Everybody knew it. And in fact, I think many of us said that what delayed that massacre was the massive upheaval in the Arab world, or the beginnings of the upheaval in the Arab world. And in fact, if you look at the WikiLeaks, you'll see that Zionist General Ashkenazi was telling American officials that he planned to attack Gazi in 2010. He specifically said that. There was no objection, and of course, that means there was no objection and, in fact, cooperation, and they told the American government about this one, that they wanted a larger attack, and they were considering extending that attack into Lebanon. So we weren't surprised by this, right? And this was not just an extension of the 2008-2009 massacres, but it was a corollary of the evacuation of settlers in 2005. It became too costly to keep the settlements and ground troops in the Gaza Strip. So Israel, the Israeli government, never intended Gaza to become a livable, viable place. And that's clear when they said Gaza can have autonomy, not sovereignty, right? Autonomy, not sovereignty. Can't control air, land, sea. You might control a little bit inside, right? And that's something to keep in mind as we're moving forward with the state bid and the dangers of moving forward with the state bid and what conditions we might face in the West Bank, not just with the state bid, but generally. And the only retribution to the bombings, right, within weeks of removing the settlers from Gaza, the Zionist occupation forces were bombing Gaza, right? They had completely destroyed the economy, 65% unemployment rate, right? And they were not allowing anything to come in or go out, no trade, no nothing, and then bombed it. And nobody did anything. The only check, the only balance, the only thing that stopped, well, not even stopped, that might have deterred was the physical resistance, defending themselves. That was the only balance to mass murder. The entire world sat and watched mass murder, talked about rights day and night, did nothing. And the only people that could do anything, that did anything on the ground, where was the resistance in Gaza. Now why, right? Why all of this? Why the constant massacres? And I think it's dangerous to essentialize it and tie it to the Israeli elections. I think that's oversimplifying and even giving the Israelis an excuse, and worse more, an excuse to which Americans can relate to on a massive scale when it's nothing like that. This isn't, well, I don't want to say it's nothing like that, but it detracts from the ideology behind the foundation and the continuation of the Israeli government and the Zionist entity. And the reality is that the Israeli government, the Zionist entity, cannot exist. It cannot physically maintain itself as a racist, supremacist state without constant wars of expansion. It would not only lose international legitimacy the moment that it just sat, right? Can you imagine if for a long moment in time, people could just look at that thing and see it for what it is? What would be its place in the international scene? That's a major threat to the Zionist entity, for it to be exposed for what it is. Number one, internally it would not be sustainable, right, without essentially killing off the Palestinian population, the immigrant non-Jewish population, or otherwise, again, face all of the pressures about being a segregation or apartheid, as it is in the 48 territories at best, entity. and even perhaps some type of cleansing of even the Arab-Jewish population, because if they sat long enough, they might again relocate their own identities as Arabs and reintegrate into the Arab world, right? That's certainly a possibility. Above all that, it would lose its ability to be the military outpost of imperialism, right? So it could not survive without constant war and constant expansion, because it would either become irrelevant or it would self-implode, becoming, yeah. And so everybody was talking about the ceasefire that Hamas was considering only a day before. Well, in 1982, Yitzhak Rabin said in 1982 during the constant, the litany of invasions in Lebanon, right, around the time of the Sabra and Shatila massacre, when they were bombing the south of Lebanon, hitting the PLO, and the PLO just refused to respond for entirely way too long, Yitzhak Rabin said, the threat that we faced in 1982 was the threat of peace, the threat of a political solution. And this is, I believe, the answer as to why Gaza, the fear of stability. And I also think that with regards to Gaza, there was a massive fear about the international mobilization for a more liberated, stable Gaza. When we're seeing articles about this massive humanitarian crisis in 2020, and it's not because they only wanted to delay the possibility of that, but also because I think they wanted to have a more direct role in limiting how a more, you know, free Gaza would look. And not to be too conspiratorial, but you know, you can never be too conspiratorial when it comes to the Arab world. But in considering and looking at the changes in Egypt, the more direct relationship between the Egyptian government and Hamas, the way that Morsi was lambasted for his letter sent to the Israeli government. He was shamed for his letter sent to the Israeli government with a diplomat. This also was a way for the Zionist entity, the Israeli government, to engage in more direct discussions about the fate of Gaza with the Egyptian government. But looking to the latest massacre, we can all agree, regardless of whatever conspiracy theories we might spout, or you know, looking at history to see what was planned, it was planned, it was sanctioned, and it was materially supported by the U.S. government, and it was illegal, and it happened at a time when Palestinians in Gaza were physically weak, malnourished, unrest was foaming in the east, in Syria, up and coming in Lebanon, with attempts to weaken the resistance. So the massacre escalates in Gaza, and the response was immediate across the world. The Egyptian president, as we said, who was mocked for sending a fawning letter to the Israeli government, was racing to withdraw that same ambassador. Morsi failed to stop almost 1,000 Egyptians from entering Gaza, and there were massive negotiations trying to get them to stop. Officials were competing over who could get to Gaza the fastest, the new Mecca, right? However empty those gestures were, and they were the bare minimum, really, that could have been done. A lot more could have been done a lot easier by the Egyptian government, but they were the bare minimum that could have been done. But this was certainly not 2008. 8 horrifying days, and for those who watch the news, and I'm sorry, the you know, however terrible the description of some of the news outlets were, I think it was very clear to the American masses, certainly to the European masses, that this was a massacre, that this could not have been justified, that false narrative of being the victim was not well-founded, and in the very least did not warrant another massacre of people who had been starved and under siege for over 6 years. So 8 days of murder in Gaza met by resistance. And what we also saw was we heard from the resistance in Lebanon saying, calling on Arab states to support the resistance in Gaza, to help the people defend themselves. And almost immediately as that was said, we saw the manifestation of that resistance. And for once, Palestinians in Gaza were really able to exact a price, to defend themselves, to make Israel pay for its war crimes, right? Everybody's talked about it. The UN's had a Goldstone report. Nobody's ever done anything, but this is they were able to make them pay. And it also exposed the unity in resistance that still existed despite the attempts to cause chaos on the east, to the east of Palestine. And I was talking with Jihad earlier, and she explained, and I understood probably later on, why she doesn't like the term victory when we speak about Gaza. And it makes sense. People are maimed. They're still dying from their injuries. Over 160 murdered. There are massive shortages of humanitarian needs, from medicine to food to water and so on. Human crisis is tragic, and maybe it doesn't honor their struggle to call it simply a victory for the resistance, but it is a victory of the human will to survive despite this massacre and despite centuries of colonialism, despite what is hands down the world's greatest resources, financial and military, being poured into the Zionist entity. They were still able to stave it off. That's amazing. And if we look at the advances, there were quite a few, right? Hamas was not forced by the Egyptian mediators to renounce violence or recognize Israel as a Jewish state. Hamas was considered internationally at least a political party to be reckoned with and considered. The Zionist entity allegedly, on paper, agreed to refrain from continuing targeted assassinations. And the Israeli government, the Israeli occupation forces, were forced to end the massacre early despite massive pressure. Almost 91% of Israeli society wanted the massacres to continue. The Israeli occupation forces were forced to end those massacres. And there were no prerequisites for the ceasefire. And in fact, Hamas had an opportunity to decline the ceasefire before it accepted it, right? So it's a shift on the larger scale, perhaps a bit more forward-looking. The U.S., the U.N., the Arab League, all of these rights-based, all of these international systems that had been the ones to essentially initially define and deprive Palestinians and Arabs of their, became irrelevant. The PA, the U.S., the U.N. were not relevant in the ceasefire. They didn't play an active role. And the Egyptian government didn't just respond out of its, you know, duty. It's, you know, the current Egyptian government does not have an entirely anti-imperialist stance. But they were responding not only to pressure from their own people, but it seemed to pressure from the Arab masses. And that was also, I think, very important. On an even larger scale, this highlighted, you know, I think that the minute that Egypt lost the war in 73, that we saw almost a complete removal of any joint power in the Arab world, right? A shift to two polar ends. And what we're possibly seeing is a rebalancing of that power and the potential for a regional power that balances out the American Zionist power. And I think that is slowly being demonstrated. The reintegration, the political reintegration of the Palestinian struggle into the rest of the Arab world. People are starting to understand, talk about, and demand, and make the connections, the actual connections, between their disenfranchisement, their oppression, and the Zionist occupation of Palestine, and seeing how each feeds the other. So the reintegration, the political and physical reintegration of the Palestinian struggle into the Arab world, and therefore the increased unity in resistance despite the attempts, the really, you know, international attempts, not just American Zionist attempts, to end the resistance in Syria, in Lebanon, Iran, and elsewhere. And above all of that, we will return to the normalization of resistance, the critical part of self-determination, the refusal to be defined and to have our rights defined, and to how and when those rights are implemented by the very same people who oppress the Arabs and the Palestinians. So, and it's not a total victory by any means. It's not a total victory by any means, right? What happens in Gaza remains to be seen. There's still a siege. We don't know if that's going to end. We don't know what's going to happen in the West Bank. There's the real possibility that the West Bank might end up like Gaza, with autonomy, right, and still subject to the same massacres and conditions and siege that Gaza is left with. Now, people, you know, are talking increasingly about what's one state. What state? What type of state are we considering? Have we thought about that? So there's more space now as a result of these past few years, and certainly the most recent, to assert the Palestinian narrative. And as Hatem has often said, armed defense, armed resistance is only one critical part of the struggle. But, you know, there are others. There's boycott, divest. There's, you know, legal mobilizations. There's empowerment, education, outreach, right? But I think it should also be clear that every time anyone condemns the Palestinian armed struggle, the Palestinian resistance, what has effectively happened is an empowerment of the Zionist armed forces, occupation forces. Every time there is a condemnation or a separation between good Palestinian and bad Palestinian, acceptable resistance, unacceptable resistance, what has happened is that we have separated our people, we have separated ourselves, and we have made them more vulnerable, not just to being criminally prosecuted, but we have made them disposable and easily killed in Gaza, massacred with full impunity. So there's a real physical danger in our condemnation of armed resistance. It is not our place. We're not on the ground. But that condemnation is a role that, sadly, many people have played. And there's no reason that we can't say that people have a right to defend themselves against massacres. And so I would encourage people that to continue to do this and to not leave space for the separation or between good and bad resistance or good and bad Palestinians. There isn't. There's only resistance to occupation. There's only resistance to being killed. None of it can possibly be bad if what you're trying to do is physically live, and we're talking about on the ground in Gaza. And I think that's critical as the movement expands, especially what we're seeing in the expansion of allies and coming into the boycott, divest, sanctions movement and the boycott movement. You know, what we saw in the boycott movement in New York was this constant demand that Palestinians not say, not talk about the right to return, that Palestinians not talk about the right to resist because they wanted to attract a larger mainstream audience. Well, what happened, for example, in the food co-op boycott is that it failed, right? Things went back to the way they were. The boycott continued, and Palestinians were further demonized. This was not an opportunity to educate about Palestinians or Palestine. It was an opportunity to kind of join the chorus and say, well, those voices are unnecessary. So this is a real danger. And the young people here are in a position to be the voices who make sure that this dichotomy is not had, because it puts people in physical danger. Ultimately, all I've said is that we have power beyond that which we are taught we have. We are not what the cartoons and the movies and 24 and Homeland depict us to be. We have as many rights, as much right, as oppressed people, perhaps even more rights than any other privileged or powerful people. We can realize those rights. And I want to say, who here has a Hawiya and lives in the West Bank? How many? Raise your hand. Now, for those people who go back to Palestine like I do, right, through Israeli checkpoints and a series of humiliating, terrifying procedures, to have entered Gaza for the first time in my life, to have entered or seen Palestine, Palestinian land, right, without first being harassed, abused, and tortured by Israeli soldiers, and without traveling through Gaza with Palestinian, it's incredible. And it's like the Egyptian people said, or the elders in Egypt said, and I'm gonna close, I'm sorry, I had them, said, you know, the elders said in Egypt, they said, we couldn't dream of seeing Mubarak say, Na'am Afendim, right, present in court. How could we have dreamed up a revolution? So there is no limit to what people can do. We've seen that in Gaza, we've seen that in Lebanon, we've seen that in Tunis, we've seen that in Egypt. There's no limit to what rights we can promote and implement in the U.S. and abroad, and what movements we can build. And it is this realization that is the antithesis of Orientalism and Islamophobia, which is the detriment of colonialism and Zionist expansion. And we count on you to continue this. Thank you so much.
We're going to open it up to some discussion.
Sarah, is this going to happen? I think that might be
better. We'll take a number of them consecutively, and then Lamis will answer them. Rafiq.
I disagree with you. It is a victory. Some people know that since sort of speaking, and he was a different person even when he spoke. I mean, he was.
Okay, so I just wanted, I didn't get the sister's name. Lena, I'm sorry, and I can't see. So I think that your point about social media is that absolutely played a critical role, because it was part of exposing what was really happening, mobilizing and allowing people to coordinate. Also, you know, the role that Anonymous played. I don't know if the young folks are familiar with Anonymous here, but you know that Anonymous, which hadn't happened in 2008, 2009, declared official war on the Israeli government, essentially a cyber war, right? And there was this taunt back and forth between Anonymous and the Israeli occupation forces, or the Israeli intelligence, I don't remember which one it was, saying, oh yeah, Anonymous has tried everything, but they haven't been able to hack us. And they Anonymous issued the warning and then hacked them. But yes, I do believe that social media has allowed people to coordinate more and to expose information and decrease the reliance on major outlets, which have always been sympathetic with imperialism and Zionism, right? So there is all these alternative media. And so that was critical to dispelling that. Brother Rafiq, it's really good to see you. I lost my glasses, so I can't see. Basfursa Saeed, I know how much that you've done. And I you're absolutely right that this was a victory. And I was just giving respect, I think, to the people who are still suffering, a point that a sister brought up. But absolutely, Yani. And I'm sure, as I'm sure that you are, that I think that we're going to be seeing the release of more political prisoners after this victory. I do want to talk a little bit about Egypt, and you know, I actually went on a delegation, a lawyer's delegation to Egypt, and I had also gone to Gaza in 2009, and we were essentially placed under house arrest for 2 weeks. You know, physical altercations, begging these people, these are your brothers, I'm your sister, you know, to get in, and this was a complete turnaround, certainly now. But I think that part of what I was saying, Brother Rafiq, is that our expectations must always be higher, and there's no reason that they couldn't be. The Israeli ambassador was withdrawn, but Morsi was provided by very well-versed advisors with a whole series of options that and actions that he could undertake that would not cause any jeopardy to him or to the Egyptian people. And what he did was take the very least, the bottom two of those options that were possible. Number one, to withdraw the ambassador, and number two, to go to Gaza, right? There were options to at least not stop a shipment of supplies to the resistance that was going from Libya to Gaza. There was absolutely no reason that could have been stopped. So it's not a matter that, you know, I have an issue with any social policies. It is the political international policies that I'm critiquing, and this continuing to fall within that very framework that I, you know, we had been talking about. Yani, why are we setting the ceiling to this? There is absolutely no reason we should not be demanding. The borders right now in Rafah are not open. This is the beginning of a revolution, right? And it's not to say that the masses are not going to force accountability and a more anti-imperialist stance. That's becoming the litmus test, right? Anti-Zionist, anti-imperialist, mush bas bilhaki, not just to talk about it. Are you really doing it? People were very critical of what Morsi did. It was better than 2008. But what I'm saying is that there is no reason that any of us should be forced to accept that as the standard when so much more could be done. When the Lebanese resistance is talking about it and sending it under massive pressure, and they're not an army, right? There's no reason that the Egyptian government couldn't. And so there's no reason for us to set our standards that low. And it's setting our standards that low that makes it easier to kill, maim, to separate, to do everything, right? It's just a basic of human nature, right? You ask for less, you get less than what you ask for. So that's all I was saying.
The question was, how much, what kind of change would we expect if the Palestinians win their recognition by the UN. So we're going to hold that question and take a couple more.
So she's had her hand
I know,
up.
I know. Chris has had her hand up, but she'll...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have a way of chairing these things.
Gotcha, I'm sorry.
You... Two more, and then we'll get to them before we start another stack. Giovannis, and then the gentleman in the corner there. And we'll take this here, and then we'll let Lamis try to tackle those.
Oh my God, I'm really gonna... You know, I've said, and I don't mean this lightly or proverbially or poetically. I hate that word, proverbially, or poetically. I almost feel like any state bid at this point is, in the very least, the ideological salvation of the Zionist entity or the existence of Israel as a Jewish state. In the practical sense of the UN bid, it all depends on the conditions, right? What has been asked for essentially is autonomy, not sovereignty, which means can't raise their own army, can't control their own borders, right? So this is like another Gaza. Possibly and also very realistically. Beyond that, and equally important, is that the U.S. has repeatedly told the Palestinian Authority, yes, we'll vote with you on the condition that you agree to never pursue anything in the International Criminal Court, meaning the Zionist entity, the Israeli government, the occupation forces can do what they want, and you don't seek redress from any international agency. So add the two together, right? Borders you can't really control, autonomy, and no accountability for what the Israeli occupation forces do, right? So there's no telling. I mean, you know, maybe the world is getting to a place where, you know, impunity is no longer an option for the Zionist regime. I don't know. But what it's looking like is quite bleak. I'm not supportive of the bid. I don't know if, actually I should have known if folks here have a certain position. I asked about the Gaza attacks. They are ongoing now, right? The Friday after the ceasefire, a young man was killed and about 19 others were shot. There's no, I mean, it's just like the ceasefire with the PLO in Lebanon in the 70s or with Hezbollah now, right? The Zionist entity has never stopped. The question has always been, when are they going to find an excuse, right? To say, oh, well, this time a rocket hit us or something. You know, so they won't stop. They're not going to stop unless or until they're forced to, right, by making it more costly for them. You know, speaking about the Iron Dome, it was massively expensive every time they needed to use the Iron Dome, right? When they got $300 billion from the American government. Shafiq asked a really difficult question, raising the ceiling of rights. I think that what we saw in Gaza, you know, the victory that Brother Shafiq was Rafiq was talking about, is that continuing to engage in resistance, right? That is setting the ceiling. Refusing to accept a life of second class or servility or being killed, however that means, and not engaging in these negotiations that assume automatically that there is balance of power when there isn't, right? So what people do on the ground, I really couldn't say, and I don't know, and I couldn't guess. But I can say, you know, it actually wasn't that hard to remove the settlements from Gaza. I happened to be in the West Bank at the time it happened. It wasn't this massive operation procedure. The world didn't turn upside down, right? It wasn't that hard to remove settlements from Gaza. It's doable elsewhere. But I'm not on the ground, you know? And just like it's not hard to remove settlements from Gaza, it's not that hard to repatriate, it's probably easier, to repatriate Palestinian refugees to Palestine, right? You know, so I think talking in these terms and really going back to asserting the basic rights, these are basic rights, right? The right to live and not get killed, right? The right to live on land that's yours. And speaking of the resistance, you know, I said Hamas was speaking on behalf of the people of Gaza, But the resistance in Gaza was all forces. There was a joint resistance to the Israeli massacres, right? It was everybody that was engaged. And so when people were celebrating in the streets, you saw every flag. And that was another victory that we saw, right? The unification of Palestinians in the West Bank, in Gaza, on a real level, in 48, right, where they were getting increasingly attacked, where the Palestinian flag was flying in Akki, where it hadn't flown in so long. You know, these are massive, massive strides in reuniting the resistance, and that's what people were doing in the West Bank. They were resisting occupation forces and Palestinian Authority forces who were attempting to stop them from showing solidarity with Gaza. So they were engaging in resistance. Not only that, but for the first time in a long while, right, committees to fight back against settler terrorism and violence, which has been on the rise ever since the Palestinian Authority's repression of resistance in Palestine and the West Bank increased, Palestinians were resisting against attacks by settlers, right? So the resistance is, unfortunately, has always been the only really on-the-ground effective tool. And then, that wouldn't be... Israeli weapons and military tactics have been a dry run, not just for the occupation forces, but... but certainly for other forces. I mean, I think that what we're seeing now play out in the Arab world is a proxy world war of sorts, right? I think part of what we're seeing in the east of the Arab world is that I don't know that the Zionist entity is ready to engage in a full-out war, considering the losses that they took from, a relatively untrained, unsophisticated resistance in the Gaza Strip. It's a possibility. That is what they articulated was their intended goal. But it also could be, and the Israelis are known for this, right? The Israelis always find a way to make their losses seem as some kind of victory, right? They never admit the extent of their losses so as not to lose the support of their own people. So I really couldn't say it's a possibility. So about 67, do we want to take one more? Or actually,
no,
about 67, just a point that I'd like to make. I'm sure that the young people here, anybody who's been exposed to the Merkez or the USPCN, I mean, there's no reason the 1967, that particular, massacre even, right, extended occupation is valid, right? It's random, right? And it legitimizes everything that happened up until that point. I mean, it's ridiculous, and I completely agree with the sister. And I have to say, when we're talking about normalizing the resistance, which is what Gaza did, right, and therefore our role to do here, right, we had been talking about one-state solution, and even up until a few years ago, I almost got physically attacked by another Palestinian organization because we were constantly talking about one state. But now, this is what people are talking about, right? And this is how things work. You keep pushing. You normalize what is normal, right? It's so important to do that. I'm sorry if I'm sounding preachy. That was kind of preachy.
Yeah, you're preachy.
Sorry. I just think I have to remind myself that, too. I even have to do that to not talk about myself. But you even have to do that in a courtroom, right? In New York, it's a very Zionist environment. And you're constantly faced with all this implicit bias, the way that people talk about the clients, the way that people talk about Muslims or masajid or whatever, and you constantly have to confront it until people get used to themselves being challenged against anti-Muslim racism. But anyway, I'm sorry. So about the UN, it goes back, the sister asked, why hasn't the UN implemented? Well, who created the UN? The very system, in everything, in every law, in every system, there is implicit bias, right, that comes from the conditions and the people that created the thing, the law, right, and the system. And then there's explicit bias, right, which, where the laws protect the powerful, for example, or landowners or the wealthy versus the poor or the working class. So, I mean, the UN was founded by the people, the colonial powers, right? And it continues to be run by those same powers. They have absolutely no interest right now in enforcing Palestinian rights. And Palestinians can't be forced to beg the same agencies and actors who cause them to lose their rights and who benefit from their oppression. That's what the UN essentially does. It's a group of people. And then the last question.
That's it. Anybody else on this side?
You know, in New York, I don't remember whether it was the Daily News or the New York Post, there was a very disgusting, and this was, you know, I think the third day into the massacres, a very disgusting front page cover, which had pictures of Palestinians on motorcycles. And I think that was after the bombings, the targeted assassination of a few Palestinians on motorcycles. And it had, the whole front page was just a picture of them and then these massive, big letters that read, "Savages." But that aside, I think that it was clear that the New York Times was really struggling, you know, it always has, really struggling to cover up and put a spin on what was happening. And I think that's directly related to the sister's question, that when you have access, when there are so many media outlets, when there are so many real-time videos, when there is so much information that's accessible, it becomes harder and harder to build the cover for the massacres. So, you know, in the mainstream media, no. But what we saw from not just, you know, smaller outlets, but even The Onion, you know, other outlets, was a complete shift. I mean, drastic, surprisingly drastic. The rhetoric amongst the masses, people, you know, people who knew nothing, knew that there was something terribly wrong with what was happening. You know, people who were not politicized, right? So I just, you know, going back, we talked about, you know, all the good and the bad things. I want to say, though, you know, in 2008, 2009 was a prime... We saw in New York a massive infiltration of Palestinian organizing circles and a massive drive. This is during the Gaza War, right? They saw the Gaza War. There was a mass international mobilization in support of the Palestinian resistance. And what the government immediately did was monopolize on that as an opportunity to weaken the movement in solidarity with Palestine. And they sent infiltrators, undercovers into all of these organizations, right, where they built their credibility and began to target the communities. And that's likely to happen again and to continue to happen. And we need to be conscious of this trend, right? Foreign policy is always, always executed domestically. So our resistance to that and our solidarity with those who are prosecuted for their political actions in the U.S. is an extension of the resistance in Gaza, right? And so that brings us to the question about Palestinian prisoners. And it wasn't a question, I think, that you were just bringing to our awareness, Bill. And Bill Chambers was involved with a delegation to Palestine focusing on political prisoners. It was bringing to our attention the struggle of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli dungeons. I think that what happens next, in part, you know, takes from what happened in Gaza. I think that if folks paid enough attention to the news, and if you watched enough, I think that there's a possibility of another prisoner exchange, and certainly the continued publication of the struggle, the resistance, right? The Palestinian prisoners, right? The people who are, like, in the heart, right? These are the people who suffered the most, who were most resistant, right? Who live in the heart, the weakest position that one could be in, right? In the heart of under Zionist occupation. You know, what they managed to do by not eating, right, was more than any agreement and negotiation over the past umpteen years did. And our ability to continue highlighting that struggle and getting people involved and organized, I would also add, and this might be a little lofty and maybe a bit academic, is also legislative, judicial, academic boycott, right? How can you engage with a government, an entity, a society that thinks that this is acceptable, that administrative detention, that indefinite detention is acceptable, right? You know, so I hope that that brings it up, but very critical, yes.
We're coming up on 9 o'clock, so I'm going to just take maybe two more.
No, I'm just asking if it's too hot a topic.
No, it's not too hot a topic. Just don't talk about Syria.
That's what...
all right, go ahead.
So to Brother Muhammad, who spoke quite eloquently, thank you. But yes, I think you're absolutely right that, you know, resisting murder is going to be a basic thing to keeping the Zionist entity at bay from expanding. A shift in the Obama administration, well, I think on the third day, first of all, we can safely assume that the Obama administration very well knew that this was going to happen, because during and after the Gaza massacres, they knew what was happening, and they knew that this was planned, and they sanctioned it, and they gifted the Zionist occupation forces $300 million, hadiyya. Right? So a shift in the administration's stance, absolutely not. A shift in the American government's stance, I don't believe so. What might influence the way that it plays out is the increased realization that the U.S. is not as big a player in the Arab Muslim world as it would like to think it is or would like to be. Now, that's not going to change the need to continue having the Zionist entity as a military outpost of imperialism, but the way that it might translate might change a little bit. That's kind of like saying, you know, I hate to make the analogy, but kind of like saying, okay, we're not going to torture them so openly, now we're going to have more disguised forms of torture. So I don't see that happening. I think I'm going to, you know, counter-revolution, looking at Egypt, not talking about Syria, though what we can safely say about Syria it is, you know, in part, what we're seeing happen through Syria is an attempt to quell, subdue, get rid of resistance in Lebanon and Iran without expanding on that, right? In Egypt and Tunisia, well, mostly in Egypt, I could speak for that. You know, Egyptian political parties are essentially split into two camps, the anti-imperialist and the pro-imperialist camp, right? The masses in Egypt increasingly are aware that the anti-imperialist camp or the anti-imperialist perspective, maybe not necessarily the political parties, are the ones that really represent the revolutionary goals and ambitions, right? Not necessarily the revolutionary parties, right? So even within the cadre of the Muslim Brotherhood, whose leadership is predominantly not anti-imperialist at least, if not altogether pro-imperialist, in the base of the Muslim Brotherhood, right, and that's why you had the split of Abu al-Futuh, is a growing demand that the party not be so pro-imperialist, right? The criticisms of the IMF, the continuation of neoliberal economic policies. And so counter-revolutionary forces being funded, influenced, supported, and propagated by imperialist tools, not just governments, right? The economic tools, the agreements, and so on.